אתם עם SBS בעברית.
Dr. Ayel Mairoz is a senior lecturer in Peace and Conflict Studies, Discipline of Sociology and Criminology from the University of Sydney. His background includes genocide studies, counter-terrorism and Middle East affairs and computer programming, and he's back on our program today to discuss Australia's decision of recognizing Palestine as a state. Dr. Ayel Mairoz, welcome back to SBS Hebrew.
Thank you.
Australia this week joined the other nations at the UN in recognising the Palestinian statehood. From your perspective, what does this mean in the bigger picture? Is it largely symbolic, or could it shift realities on the ground?
How successful this will be will depend on the coming weeks and months, because, yes, symbolically an important factor, 157 member states of the UN support now Palestine out of 193, I think that's over 80% of the total membership. But in terms of both medium and long-term effects, I think we need to see what is going to happen, because on the ground in Gaza, not much will change immediately as long as the Americans continue to support the Israeli government's policies. The Americans are the only ones that can make a significant enough difference to change cost-benefit analysis in Jerusalem. But also in terms of what is going to happen later, come elections in Israel, whether a new government or the same government, this, I think, will be the test case. States can easily say we recognize a country such as Palestine. Some, many do, and a few don't. But then how will that be translated into meaningful gains, both diplomatic, security, economic? I think that will be the test case. So, for example, some of the member states and the Western member states, including Australia, have conditioned their recognition on a number of measures that the Palestinian Authority is supposed to be taking, including preventing Hamas from taking part in any future government, demilitarizing not only Hamas, but the whole of the West Bank and Gaza, changing, if you like, the education system in both places so that there's not, you know, all the things that Israel has been alerting about in relation to hatred that is taught in Palestinian schools is changed. Stopping to pay families of terrorists, that has been also something that the Israelis were very angry about. All of these things are now supposedly promises made by the chairman of the Palestinian Authority to Australia and to some other states, and that's why they're saying we conditioned our recognition. So how will that take effect? In what ways? The Palestinians are saying that this should take 2 years, so we're not looking at immediate changes in the short term. But Israel continues to be defiant on its part, including threatening some potentially far-reaching steps following the meeting of the UN that could complicate things, could attract backfire from these member states, including the Western ones. So a lot is happening. A lot is can change dynamically in the coming days even.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack there. Is this case comparable to anything in history that the UN's ever seen before?
No, I don't think so. I think the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been a challenge for the UN for many decades, but until now we have not seen strong action in relation to Israel. And you could say maybe the UN was taking action in different parts of the world over the years, but not in the same way, not in the same intensity, and not with such a strong quorum of most member states that only the U.S. is objecting and protecting Israel in that sense in relation to what is taking place in Gaza at the moment.
Many would object with what you're saying right now simply because there seems to be, or at least the optics are, strong antipathy towards Israel. So why would you say that the UN would have protected Israel in the past?
I didn't say the UN would protect Israel. What I'm saying is that the UN had taken numerous resolutions, mainly the General Assembly, against Israel and in favor of creating a Palestinian state, but never actually taken the necessary step to implement those if you like, threats and so on. So in that sense, the international community has not been very helpful, if you like, from a lot of people's perspective in helping to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by forcing both sides, including Israel, to the painful concessions that are required and could have prevented so much bloodshed.
I just wanted to know what your thoughts are when Penny Wong says that these steps that Australia is taking in recognizing Palestinian statehood would be advancing a two-state solution. Do you think that these are the first steps in order to create a two-state solution? It has to start with the UN and there has to be a consensus before they can actually implement this?
In order to move forward with anything in relation to the future of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you need an Israeli government that is willing to do so, and we don't have that. And even the opposition has voted in favor of denouncing the idea of a Palestinian state. So I don't see any immediate change in terms of situation on the ground, because there is no government in Israel that is willing to do so. Whether a future government will, I guess, will also depend on, you know, a lot of different calculations. Will depend on the Americans, will depend on any future move with Saudi Arabia in relation to normalization with the Arab world. So there are a lot of moving parts, a lot of dynamic things that could change, but I don't see major changes before the elections that could come, either early elections or at the latest in a year's time in Israel.
Some of the countries that have come forward, like the UK, Australia, Canada, they've all come with different preconditions for recognizing Palestinian statehood. Some of them have said that they don't want Hamas being there, and that's one of the preconditions in which they will recognize a Palestinian state. Hamas seem pretty adamant that they're not going anywhere. So do you think that this bargaining chip from these countries is quite futile, given that they're completely at odds with what Hamas wants?
I think we have to look at the details here. Hamas has already said that they are willing not to take part in any future government, at least in the short term, before the elections in Palestine. So I think from that perspective, that's not an impediment. What Hamas said that it's not willing to do is to demilitarize, is to surrender its weapons, or for the senior leaders to leave the Gaza Strip. It said that it's not willing to release their hostages until Israel completely withdraws. So these are the major difficulties in reaching any kind of an agreement, even for a ceasefire, let alone for the future. I think this is where the governments that condition their support for a Palestinian state on certain aspects, as we talked about, this is where they will be tested. What will supporting or recognizing Palestine mean on the ground in terms of their support for major changes that are required in the Palestinian Authority that is very unpopular, that is corrupt, that cannot handle at the moment Gaza Strip, not even the West Bank. So how will things change? That will determine a gradual shift, hopefully, in making sure that this is not just a futile, as you say, just semantics, but rather a support from the international community to any kind of ceasing of decades-long violent conflict and advancing towards a very, very long distance peace.
The two-state solution has been the framework for decades, but given the current realities, including the settlements, internal Palestinian divisions like the PLO versus Hamas, and general mistrust, is it still viable, or are we looking at an entirely different future?
I don't think in the short term anything seems viable. So you have three major options or proposals. One is the two-state solution, one is the one-state solution, and the third is some kind of a federation. The one-state solution is not possible simply because Israel and Israelis will never agree to give millions of Palestinians in the occupied territories voting rights. So that's, I think, is excluding the possibility. There's also the question of whether the two people living side by side together is going to be viable. Even small efforts by small minorities to light up fires and to use violence will just deteriorate everything and destroy any kind of trust building that may be on the cards. So that's, I think, the problem is with the all those who say we should have a one-state solution. I think the two-state solution, the importance of two-state solution is other than the fact that it's supported by, you know, most of the world and the Arab states, is that we need a separation as much as possible between the two people. The violence, the hatred, the revenge, sense of revenge between the two sides after so many decades of violence is such that the more we can separate the two peoples, at least for a long time, I would say, the better are the chances that we can try to bring security to the Israeli people, that without it, no peace will be possible, but also, you know, some sense for the Palestinian people that they have sovereignty and that they have independence, even if a limited one. So I think while in the short term, and especially with the current Israeli government, I don't see any future now for a two-state solution. I think this is the least problematic goal in the long term, but it will take a lot of changes and a lot of hard work.
What does a two-state solution look like?
Well, the two-state solution essentially means that there will be a Palestinian state declared. What will be the borders? How will the two parts, Gaza Strip and the West Bank, be connected? What will happen to the settlements, hundreds of thousands of settlers, even though most of the settlers are living in very particular, or most of them are living in particular areas? My sense is that it will have to be some kind of negotiated swap of areas, that some parts of the West Bank will be given to Israel in return for some other lands and elsewhere, but certainly not an easy solution, but an inevitable one. In terms of demilitarization, that's really important because, as I said, security for or sense of security for Israelis paramount, and without demilitarizing both Gaza and the West Bank, I don't see that is happening in terms of Israel's willingness to accept and allow for the creation of a Palestinian state. I think what is important is that while the world is there, and even the Americans, without Israeli consent for the creation of a Palestinian state, there will be no Palestinian state. I think a lot rides on the dynamics within Israel, a lot rides on the elections, and on the Americans to an extent in terms of their decision of how much leverage and how much force they are willing to impose on the sides, and in this case, mainly on Israel.
I mean, that sounds like really, honestly, the biggest challenge to come. How to draw up the borders between Palestinian state and Israeli state, and whether each side would be able to recognize each other as neighbors. That sounds like it's going to be the biggest challenge, wouldn't you say?
I'm a genocide scholar. My area is trying to prevent mass killings. And so my immediate interest is to stop the killing. This is paramount. And that does not require us to resolve all these very, very difficult, vexing challenges. It also, in my opinion, will improve the chances of ever resolving these. The sooner we do that, the better it is, not only for Israelis, but I would say also for Jews around the world. I try to deal with the pariah state that Israel has become. But if we look at history, we can look at Germany and Japan that in 1945 were even worse situation than Israel is, pariah state. Decades later, look where they are. I think an important part of why that was is because there were no mixes of people between these countries and the allies. The Americans, the British, the French did not live within Germany or within Japan. So it was easier to separate and to stop the violence altogether. So we can learn some things, but there are still challenges. What we can look at, for example, is Rwanda, where the Tutsi and the Hutu lived together in the same villages or in the same towns. After the genocide of 1994, they've managed to do so. What can we learn from other places? How can we do it? How can we prevent more violence on either side, I would say, from the both the Jewish side and the Palestinian side, in order to try and embark on that difficult and long-term road towards peace? It will be this will be the main challenge.
Why do you think countries chose this moment to recognize Palestinian statehood? I mean, given that Hamas remains in power in Gaza, they still have civilian hostages from Israel. Why now? What propelled everything to this moment?
If you look at the day before the 7th of October, from memory, there were maybe around 140 states already recognizing Palestine. I don't think there was a major shift. If we look at the 157, there may have been 17 countries that decided to do so. But certainly, not only the killing, in the mass killing in Gaza, but also the accusation that Israel was intentionally creating starvation in Gaza resonated very, very powerfully in a lot of the countries that decided to change their view. A second one was that there was seemed to be no solution in sight. And so these countries, in order to feel or think that they may be able to do something, and knowing how limited their ability is, decided that maybe they will be able to do that in that way, and obviously also to cater for very powerful public opinion negative to Israel in their own countries out of domestic political calculations.
If Palestinian statehood is actually validly recognized, then how does that materially affect Israel as a country?
This is an important question, because a lot of the accusations against Netanyahu was that he was using Hamas for years before the 7th of October to disrupt, if you like, the prospects of a Palestinian state by ruling and dividing, supporting Hamas so that Hamas and the Palestinian Authority don't see things eye to eye. And so I think this is an important question to look at. I think part of the ideological right in Israel that has no room for a Palestinian state, especially in the West Bank, that is very dear for this part of the population out of a religious sentiment, ideology, then the more there is support for the creation of Palestinian state, the more Israel is in trouble diplomatically by being seen as the disruptor of any future to the solution. So if Israel could say, look, we are not disrupting negotiations for peace and for a solution, it's the other side, then it was used very cynically by Netanyahu for years and very successfully so. And now, when most of the countries are in support and the Palestinian Authority is in support, then it becomes harder for Netanyahu to make that argument. In terms of the, if you like, the radical elements in Netanyahu's government, the settler movement, that's not even an issue, because for them, how the world sees Israel is less of an less important than it is for Netanyahu and the Likud. So we see different shades of if you like, concern. Obviously, at the end of the day, the main concern for the Israelis and for the Israeli government lies within the U.S. Whether and how, to what extent, will the U.S. be affected by this move? At the moment, it seems that Trump is all supportive of Netanyahu. But that could change, knowing Trump, how he operates. That could change if Trump senses that this is not in his favor or in the favor of the U.S. to continue back up Netanyahu.
Now, I want to bring it back firstly to the U.N. Many people, especially Jewish people, are very suspicious of the U.N. as an entity, and they claim that it's very anti-Semitic in nature. Do you believe it's anti-Semitic?
Look, I think the whole question around anti-Semitism is quite a complex one. There's certainly a very high increase in anti-Semitic incidences since 7th of October and the Israeli retaliation in Gaza. But on the other hand, it is very difficult in many cases to separate between anti-Israel or anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. And I think that a lot of the situations where Jewish people feel this has been anti-Semitic may be to do with anti-Israel or anti-Zionism, and again, linked directly to what is taking place in Gaza. In terms of the UN, I think that this is also a complex issue. I think the UN, of course, is made up of 193 countries. There's a lot of countries there that belong to the global south, to the Islamic world, to the Arab nations. Where does anti-Semitism start and where does anti-Israel or anti-Zionism start or ends? This is a very difficult question. Obviously, the UN for a long time has been taking a very anti-Israeli, if you like, stance. If you look at the Human Rights Council and the number of resolutions against Israel versus the number of resolutions against other, even in some cases, worse violators of human rights, then there's certainly anti-Israel sentiments. For me, there's a lot more anti-Israel and anti-Zionist sentiments that derive from the Israel-Palestinian conflict than anti-Semitism. But certainly that is very much so in the case of many situations within the UN.
Dr. Mayroz, how should Australia, and particularly Jewish Australians who care deeply about Israel's security, understand this recognition? Does it move us closer to peace, or does it risk entrenching divisions?
And I don't want to speak for the Jewish Australian community, but for me, as far as I can deduct, what a lot of Jewish Australians feel and want is two things. One is safety and security, and the other one is less of a discord and violence within Australia, intercommunal issues. To many of them, their safety and their security is tied with Israel's safety and security. But this is a very problematic and questionable question, because in some cases, supporting Israel blindly out of that belief that supporting Israel is under any condition good for them is not necessarily the case. I think that in many cases, standing up to moral rights and human rights should precede and is in the best interest of the Jewish Australian community. And when Israel doesn't follow that same line of logic, then they should stand up. I think that will improve their safety, their security and the relationship within intercommunal relationship within Australia. For those who are concerned about these two things, I think that you should follow your moral conscience and human conscience and support whatever it is that you think is best, not necessarily what Israeli government, this government or another, thinks it's best. From the academic perspective, I think a lot of the challenges that we're facing with Israeli-Palestinian conflict and other conflicts has to do with what we call the national interest. What is the national interest in this case, maybe, of Israel? And who determines what the national interest is? And what factors and what priorities should determine the national interest? And you'd have a lot of different people within Israel and outside of Israel with different opinions. If you're a religious Jew who believes that the West Bank was promised to us by God, then obviously the importance of Israel retaining possession of the West Bank is very important for you. But if you're a secular Jew, you might not prioritize that in the same way. So I think it is really important also to have a critical discussion about what is in the national interest of Israel, and that should also take form and take part in how Jews, how Israelis look at the conflict, look at the painful concessions that they might have to do or make, and factor that in to the overall views that they have.
That's precisely the issue, because it's such a pluralistic society that eventually you're always going to meet different people with different perceptions and interpretations of what conditions they believe should apply. And that's not just on the Israeli side, that's as much on the Palestinian side as well.
To an extent, even though, if you like, Palestinians under, 17 years of Hamas dictatorship rule, but also dictatorship in the West Bank, does not allow as much freedom for Palestinians to voice their opinions and to push for their opinions as it does Israelis in Israel.
Dr. Eyal Mayroz, thank you so much for joining us again on SBS Hebrew.
No worries. עקבו אחרינו והפיצו אותנו דרך דף הפייסבוק שלנו.